Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And you are back in the House of Mystery. I am your host today, surprise, surprise, Dave North Martino. And on the other side of the country is the great Alan R. Warren. How you doing, Al?
You just woke me up.
What are
you?
What do you want? Wake up, Al. Wake up.
What do you want?
This is a mutiny. I've taken over.
Yeah. Well, it's all right because I need my beauty rest.
Yeah, you need some sleep.
Yeah, I do.
Get you a nice little bear to sleep with. Well, you have your dogs. So.
I have my dogs. That's enough hair.
Sleep with your dogs.
enough. Fun. Yeah. That's enough of that shedding. You know, it's springtime. They shed a lot.
Yeah. That's right. My cat, too. I'm having that problem. Well, anyway, today we have a fantastic writer who I've been reading for a long time. His newest novel is called The Rock of Bop, a Seattle Bop Mystery, Book 3. Let's welcome Reb McGrath to the program. Hey, Reb, how you doing?
Doing fine, David. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no problem. Well, we'll see if you say that at the end. That's what Al always says, so I'm going to steal that. So let's start in the beginning. You know, how did you discover that you wanted to write?
You know, that goes back to university, and it was a curious path. I mean, I fell in love with Lord Byron's work and wanted to be Lord Byron, have a swashbuckling romantic life. So I wrote poetry and ended up having in the school paper my own column. I published weekly. I produced and directed and acted in 3 different plays.
Oh, wow.
And then I moved up to Toronto for reasons that are probably clear to everybody at that time, back in the late, the 60s. And there in Toronto, I continued writing poetry for a while until I drifted towards freelance journalism. I wrote book reviews and personality profiles. And I was actually doing well at it. I had a syndicated column. This would have been in the mid-70s before I realized that I wanted to come back to the States. And I found when I moved out to San Francisco that none of my writing experience gave me any cred in the industry. I couldn't get any gigs to write for the newspapers. They basically told me I'd have to go out to the suburbs and work for a little weekly gazette or whatever. And I said, no, if I'm going to do anything here rather than start from scratch again, I'd always toyed with the idea of writing a novel, I began trying to write a novel. And 3-4 years later, I ended up with a completed book called The Suiting, my first published book.
Well, did you find that doing that type of work, do you feel it made you more of an efficient writer when it came to novels and other types of fiction work?
Oh, definitely. I learned I was working in tight spaces. I mean, some of the profiles I did were 1,000 words long, so I had to learn how to structure them, get to the point very quickly. And I also was working had a big influence on my life. I worked for about 8 years in retail copywriting in direct mail once again. And you've got to get your hook set in the opening sentence, because you've only got 2 or 3 sentences before readers move on to the next page. So these things influenced me.
Well, I would assume, you know, it sounds like that would doing copywriting and having to be so, so immediate in your language, that must have really translated to fiction.
Oh, it did. That all-important influence. Now, in retail copywriting at that time, you've got a picture like a 40-50-page book of ads with 12 different ads on the page. Mm-hmm. You're competing with the other dozen ads, and you only have like basically a sentence to be creative in, and then you've got to get into listing fabrics, all of these legal things that must appear in direct mail advertising. So I became very, very much focused on writing compelling sentences to draw people in.
Well, what was it like, you know, you talk about The Suiting and you won an award for that. What was it like getting your first book deal and getting an award?
Gosh, that's a great question. To give you the best answer I can give you, first of all, it was a great honor. I mean, I was thrilled by it, but it soon became apparent that the award itself didn't translate into any great difference in terms of my sellability for an agent at that point. I had started off with Tor 2 books and was, like many other writers, after a couple of books, I found myself dropped, and we moved over to changed agents. We moved to Dell, but despite the Stoker Award and the good reviews I'd gotten, the only deal we were able to get was going into the new line for Dell, which was the Abyss line, was paperback. So I went from hardcover to paperback, took a loss in prestige. I was tied up for years on two books that I was writing under intense deadline pressure, and I don't think I did my best work. So the Stoker Award, it was an honor, but it didn't translate into anything really useful for me.
Mm. It's tough out there.
Yeah, it is.
Well, now, after that, I think you started going into the Boss McTavern series, and that's where the first was that the first kind of inklings of that character and that story happened after that 4-book deal.
No, it was interesting genesis there. I went into after the 2-book deal with Dell, I went into a long, long period, almost 15 or 20 years, what I call the desert. No matter what I proposed, no matter what I wrote, nobody was biting. And one of the main issues that people had with my work was that I was doing what I insist are not novellas, but short novels, about 40,000 to 50,000 words. And nobody was touching. I did the first draft of a Boss McTavern book called Southern Scotch, was written during that long period, and I ended up rewriting that once I started self-publishing with Amazon. I said, okay, I could take the skills that I've gained since I wrote that, produce an even more tightly knitted story that's better told and might be of more appeal to readers.
Well, that period of time, I mean, it must have been extremely difficult. How did you persevere through that time and continue writing?
Dave, it was sheer stubbornness and belief that I had the talent. I just refused to say die. But difficult? I mean, I had gone from a period. Now, when The Suiting came out, I was working at a bookstore in Atlanta, Oxford Books, great bookstore. And people would come in to see me. I got to meet all of these incredible writers through their PR people with major publishers. But this changed. As I went on and was unable to, after The Suiting, Makoto came next. As soon as I went into the 2-book deal with Dell, I found myself almost like persona non grata. I wasn't taken seriously by the people, aspiring novelists that I worked with. And it was difficult. So I don't know. During that period, I turned out 6 or 7 short novels that I eventually went on to publish on Amazon. But again, time after time, no matter what I did, I would send out feelers and everything, and it's no, too short, too this, too that. I call that the curse of the tutus. It's too much of everything.
Well, you know, I'm wondering too, you know, with short novels, and it seems like you got new life with the advent of the ebook and Kindle. Is did that really kind of inject something new and fresh into your career?
Yes, it did. I mean, it restored my sense of myself as a writer. I made peace with the fact that many other writers who are publishing with traditional publishers don't accept the legitimacy of writers who publish ebooks or ebooks themselves. I mean, I get that. It's nothing I can say is going to change that, except that wonderful books in the past and the present have been published independently and been, you know, terrific works and gone on to do well. So on the other hand, it does pose a problem, since most agents and many publishers, not all, but will not even consider publishing something that's previously appeared in the ebook.
What got you into mystery? What was that draw to go from mystery and crime fiction?
Well, the draw had always been there from the start, Dave. When I wrote the Suiting, I considered it a mystery with a supernatural twist. Now, I don't know in terms of years or anything, I don't know how this parallels the movie. What was it, Angel Heart with Mickey Rourke? Yeah. Might have been around the same time, but that was basically a mystery with a supernatural twist. And it got sold as horror. And by contract, I was committed to write horror. After 2, I was begging my agent to let me pitch a mystery, which I'd started. It actually went on 15 or 20 years later to turn into the second Boss McTavin book, The Alcatraz Correction. But once again, I was told, no, just give us 2 more horror novels. Well, after 4 horror novels, I was officially a horror writer. But the mystery had appealed to me from the start, so it wasn't something that just came out of the blue. I'm fascinated by constant, like, issues coming up. Just when you think you've solved something or drawn a bead on something, have it going off in a different direction, that has always fascinated me.
Well, you mentioned Boss McTavern. Who is he? Can you give us a little bit about him?
Yeah. Boss McTavern was my take many years later on a famous TV show called Have Gun, Will Travel, with Richard Boone playing a character named Paladin, who, you know, goes on and takes on cases that appeal to him. And now Boss McTavern began as a Southern Scottish athlete who crashed in the South. And as I put it in my pitch for it, Boss had a fatal attraction for the South, which failed to return his affection. He's in the wrong place one night, is half-blinded, beaten, scarred, everything. Comes back years later to get the men who did this to him. But he evolves into a paladin-type character in San Francisco, running an outfit he calls Boss Corrections. So instead of revenge, he seeks to correct things that he feels need to be rebalanced. So he was a 6'2", rail thin, Southern Scot, and the pitch, I think that one of the big, I thought one of the biggest appeals would be his accent. He's kind of a half Scottish, half Southern accent that he's made all his own. So it's kind of like half Rhett Butler and and half something else.
Well, you also, you know, with the Seattle Bot Mysteries, you had, it was kind of a spinoff, right, from Boss McTavern, and with DB, a.k.a. Chief Armstrong. Who is this character? Because there's definitely kind of a little bit of a difference between these characters.
There is, and I think we're getting into the creation of a Boss Corrections Seattle Bot universe here. At the DB starts off, when we first meet him in the second Boss McTavern mystery, he's a kind of a young, brilliant hacker, thief, just a bad hombre, and he's a very very height challenged. He's 5'4", so he's got a lot of anger and a lot of rage inside him. And Boss takes him under his wing, keeps him out of jail, and takes him on eventually as a partner. Now, through the course of just as Boss evolves into a more humane character over the next three books, DB also grows. He's fascinated by he looks up to Boss. I mean, he reveres him. And eventually, at the end of the fourth Boss McTavin book, he's sent to Seattle to run a new division of Seattle BOP. Well, actually, it becomes Seattle BOP when he gets there. So we meet him. He changes, takes a new name, becomes Chief Armstrong. But by that time, by the time the series will have ended, DB will be with him for three Boss McTavin novels and eventually Seattle BOP mysteries. And I think there's a real, very strong character arc there that it's time to say goodbye after the fifth book. But we trace him from punk thug to tall walking 5'4" dude.
And he's taller than I am.
He is. Well, he is. How tall are you?
Well, I'm 5'2 3/4" or something like that. Yeah, I rounded I'd round it to 5'3", but the nurse told me that I wasn't quite 5'3".
That's when he's wearing heels.
Only with heels.
DB pads his shoes with insoles, and he has a height-adjusting chair in his office so that he can elevate himself to meet the eyes of anybody he's seated with.
I've never done that. I've got to try that.
It works for him. He's been a lot of fun to be with, and I think the Seattle BOP series brings something new to the genre. I would call it, instead of hard-boiled, I regard it as glitter noir. Got a little bit of razzmatazz, it's got some humor, and it's not just a drunken hero with his eyes on the bars.
Well, with humor, you know, you talk about, like, you know, people who do stand-up and stuff, they need, like, comedic timing. Do you feel that to do some of the humor in the books that you need to kind of have some sort of maybe a timing in your prose?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Could you throw that at me again?
Yeah, well, no, I'm just wondering if you know, there's with comedians, they have to have kind of a form of timing, a rhythm, let's say, to how they deliver a joke. And with humor in books, I was just wondering if you think there's, you know, maybe a rhythm or a timing that goes along with making something funny when you're writing it out.
Definitely. I'm not sure. I mean, I know what you're saying, and I agree with you. I'm not sure that I have it down to a science where I can explain it, but I'm very aware of timing. And I'm also very aware that for something like the humor to work, especially dealing in the third person as I do in the way these books are written, it's essential that DB not always be on top of every joke. I mean, he's sometimes jokes on him, and that's where the humor comes from. He eventually accepts it, but he's not always aware at the start that he's a joke's being played on him.
So he's kind of a straight man in a way.
Yes.
Now, I'm wondering with Boss and DB, and you have a very colorful cast of characters in your stories. How do you experience those characters? Do you hear them? I'm just trying to find out if you're hearing voices. But I'm just wondering if you hear them, if you have an inner monologue, if you hear the rhythm of language as you're writing.
Yeah, in fact, I write longhand, and I'm very aware as I'm writing and feeling the pencil on the pages of my Moleskine notebooks. I'm very aware. I hear the voices in my head as I write. Sometimes characters will tell me to back up if I move on too quickly. It's like, hey, I'm not finished yet. Add some more. I hate it when I have to kill them off too. I've killed off a few major characters lately.
Have you ever killed off a character? I'm stealing Al's question here, but have you ever killed off a character who's based on somebody that you didn't like?
Yes.
We don't have to tell anybody. And nobody's... No. We won't tell
that
anybody.
I did that more... I was more prone to do that back in the unhappy horror years. We had some pretty, pretty splashy exits for characters I didn't like.
Yes. I know because I've read some of those books. And, and I do some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. So, but we won't talk about that.
Let's let that go.
It's funny. Well, you know, I remember, you know, one of your books. Well, actually, you know, before I go there, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned Moleskine Notebooks. I think you have a very interesting process for creating a book. And you're using, could you elaborate on that?
Sure. This won't be for everybody, but I'll end up with, even for the short books that I'm doing of anywhere from these days, my books are going up to 50, 60,000 words maximum, I'll end up with a dozen Moleskine notebooks. And I always start the same way. I'll start off with one of a particular color and usually white to get me going, and just spend a full notebook just asking questions. Typical question, just to pick one out of a hat. How am I going to handle it? Taking two characters from Seattle, moving them to Tucson without spending a fortune of time on backstory. Pages on that over the next year. I would ask myself, are we going to reference the characters in Seattle, Bob, or is there a way that I just make it as a clean start? This is the sort of thing that I'll be spending the most time on. Little pages of character profiles as I bring new characters in. When the first book notebook is finished, I'll spend another notebook where I actually begin fooling around with the outline, just putting down necessary scenes, not even in any particular order. It's just I know I have to have a scene set in Tombstone, for example. What are they doing in Tombstone? Question, question, question. Mm. And eventually, after I've filled two or three notebooks, I'll have the confidence to start fiddling around with opening lines. Just I might write 50, I might write 75. I think the most I ever did was 86. And when I get the one that is right, usually then I'll feel the itch where it's time to start writing. Take out a different color notebook and begin the first chapter.
Well, you also used, I believe, Dragon Naturally Speaking for a while to get your prose into the computer, so that because since you do write a lot of the stuff out by hand, how did that work for you?
It was working fine. There were some glitches as we went along. I mean, I wish I was using it. The short answer to your question is I can't use it now because I had a complete computer crash that erased everything that I had.
No.
So I don't even have the program now. Wow. I might look into getting it again because I feel that I found my way around the glitches is basically to examine every page or two as I go along so I don't have 400 or 500 pages to go through, like, you know, little glitches that Dragon will naturally occur. It was very handy, and I could transcribe a novel far more quickly. Instead of, like, typing, I might be able on an average day, I think the most I'm really capable of typing from my handwritten notes is 10 pages. With Dragon, I could do 20 or 30 pages. Dearly.
Well, you seem to, I think I've seen you, you go to internet cafes and coffee shops and libraries to do some of your writing. You must like to be out. Do you need the hustle and bustle to write, or can you write in quiet? How does that work for you?
I used to need the hustle and bustle, and also I didn't have internet, so I relied on their Wi-Fi. And the Wi-Fi has no longer been an issue, and I've been able to get more attractive home digs. So I've actually been very, very content with writing at home. So that's been a major change in the past couple of years.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's been a big change for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, change.
It's been crazy.
Change or stop, give it up. I'm not ready to give it up, so got to do it at home. So I do enjoy the quiet. The building itself that I'm in is very, very quiet. The internet is, and it will be free internet when I move to Tucson in the apartment. So that's not likely to change, but I'll probably spend more time, like force myself to take a break now and then just to get out and meet people a little bit in the cafe.
Hmm. It helps to recharge.
Yeah.
Definitely, is that how you get your characters through the people that you see and when you're out and about?
Some of it, and you see and you'll hear the darndest things when you're out in public. I I can't imagine. I don't know how people do it who do all of their work at home and don't get out and interact with people. I mean, this is where we learn from people who are younger than us and in different stations of life. We learn things that can be incredibly useful to our work.
Hmm. Oh, absolutely. And, in your work, you do a lot of, with language, you do a lot of wordplay and literary allusion. Do you feel that the language and prose is as important as the plot and your characters?
I do. It's something, how can I explain it? It's not like when I'm writing, I never have the urge or the voice whispering in my ear, it's time to get clever or cute here. It's not like that. I just find myself playing. It's my nature to play with language as I write. Mm. And I like this. Some of the writers that I like that aren't with us any longer, so I can mention them. There was a wonderful mystery writer named Lawrence Sanders who wrote the Deadly Sins and the Commandment books. He was a brilliant stylist who wrote in very, very successful, highly commercial books. Nobody ever complained that he was too stylistic. So I look for this. I mean, I love it. If I find somebody who can bring a scene to life or just add a little bit of color to the page, I'm in heaven. I'm in reading heaven if I find that.
Well, it reminds me of, when I read Mastery, which became Monster Time later when you republished it, and then I read Angel Kiss. And I think I've told you this before. You kind of an Angel Kiss. It was, I thought it was very brilliant. You were able to pare down your writing to, I guess, make it more palatable for the mainstream, but you still retained your colorful voice. And was that a natural outgrowth of your writing, or did you do it consciously for the market?
I didn't do it consciously for the market. I think... let me see, Mastery. Yeah, Mastery was the longer book. Mm. Took a lot of research. I thought it was going to kill me. I mean, we're writing Mastery. And this was before the internet, computers at that point.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Writing pages to meet deadlines and faxing them at work. The job I had in the bookstore, faxing them off to Dell, as I got them. So I wanted something simpler, basically, to give myself a little bit of a break, take some of the pressure off me, and to have a little bit more fun in the writing. And I think the simplicity is you're looking at was, so the simplicity evolved from that rather than my decision to write a more mainstream book.
I see. It's interesting because I found it very, I kind of used that as a template for kind of paring down my writing a bit. while still retaining my voice, and it was just very influential.
Oh, thank you. I think rather than a highly literary or highly elusive style of writing, some of the color, I guess, you know, maybe a little bit stylistic, a little bit colorful. In one of the Boss McTavin books, I think it is the, I believe it was the Alcatraz Correction. He's sitting outside He was sitting outside a hospital ward. And he's just looking at the rain outside, and he compares it to a Robert Mitchum type of sky. And
yeah,
that to me, I mean, that felt very natural. I didn't have to strain for that. It's not like I was straining for the high notes or anything. It just came out very naturally. Mm-hmm. That was Boss putting it.
That's a great book.
Oh, thank you.
All the books in the series are great. And, you know, I remember reading through those books. One of them focuses on some of the retail experience that you had and shoplifting that was happening. And
Seattle Lid.
Yes. Okay. And some of the Aikido that you studied ended up in the book. So it seems like you really like to draw from your own experiences and put that into your fiction.
Yeah, this goes back to, well put, this goes back to your question about, you know, going out, getting out and about, not just to recharge, but to be exposed to what is going on. Nobody could have made up the scenes that I put into Seattle Red about organized retail crime and shoplifting are things that I've seen for years, and they've never been worse than they are in this city. People think I'm exaggerating, but I see people walking into a pharmacy and just bold as brass, just walking straight over to the beer cooler, grabbing 2 12 packs, and marching right out the door past the security guard. I mean, this is happening. And I wouldn't have known it if I hadn't seen it rather firsthand.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's very interesting. Did you have to do, besides your actual experience, did you have to do any research to fill in the gaps in the book, or were there just enough experiences for you to create a novel about that?
No, I could have, if all I was doing, I could have written a novel if all I were doing was taking the scenes that I had seen and just, staging them and staggering them throughout the book. I wouldn't have had to do any research, but I wanted to get into the growth and the spread of organized retail crime, what separates it from shoplifting. That takes research. All of my books require research, extensive research before I sit down to write. Except for the things where I'll find that things I was unaware that I needed to research, and that's where I leave the typical blanks. You know, fill in, describe the train, and just keep writing without getting bogged down in the stuff that I don't know. Let's work with what I do.
Well, you're a big fan of trains, too.
Yes, I am, and I've got a doozy of a train ride coming up in the House of Bop.
Yes,
it's the one that's coming out this year. Deals with one of my favorite favorite trains. The greatest of them all is the 20th Century Limited, and we have a serial killer whose one obsession is that particular train, and they have a heck of a way of roping him in the novel, staging inventing a train that resembles it, a portion of a train that resembles the 20th Century Limited.
Interesting.
So I had a lot of fun with that. Books on the century. I've spent hours and hours online, like looking at the cars, seeing how the porters dress. What do the menus look like? What food were they serving? I had to get all of this down.
Wow.
So.
And that your love of trains kind of came in, I think, in Mastery, and then just went on into many of your books.
Well, it did. You had the train ride on Mastery. I wrote a book. One of the best novels I wrote, short novels I wrote when I was in the desert, was a little book called Nobility, about a broken down guy. I envisioned John Travolta in the part, just broken down guy who's on a train, meets a woman who turns out to be his something like an angel, but not exactly an angel, and they take on a gang of pickpockets. It's a wonderful little book.
Yes, it is.
Suspenseful, romantic, and got some good wordplay in it, too.
Yep.
That's the one where we have the acrostics, the abba-dabba-dabba, the sentences that mean the same, like both backwards and forward.
Oh, yes, an acrostic. I remember some writer, I can't think of her name, she used the term acrostic eye, and I always liked that. Yeah, for something, but she used that term. I think it was Starhawk. back in my hippie days, right?
It's an acrostic or anagram. I'm just drawing a blank here, and I can't think of it. It's the backward and forward. It would be like, ABBA, ABBA. So
yeah,
these word configurations begin appearing in the windows and everything, and I got to go back and reread that. It's one of my favorites.
Hmm. It is a good book. And then, you know, also The Gathering Magic of Snow, which is, I call it a McGrathian masterpiece, right? But it's very autobiographical. And you brought in a lot of stuff, and you could see it from your other books.
Yeah, that was the Vanishing Magic of Snow. The Vanishing Magic.
Oh, The Vanishing Magic of Snow, yes. My memory.
Gosh. And wordplay in the title itself, because it takes on a different meaning. I mean, the snow melts and vanishes, but also the only hope they have to, in the course of the novel, this guy's salvation depends on vanishing to go back in time to fix something that he left undone, or did totally botched back in the 70s. But that was based on my years in Toronto and some of the people that I had actually met, like Margaret Atwood and Leonard Cohen. And I figured, you know, I just wanted to... and there was a famous magician that has Sonny Storm, based on Doug Henning. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
Yes.
But he was very, very famous at one point, but he fell under the... This is true. I met him in Grossman's Tavern, one of the most charismatic people I've ever met, had a brilliant career, and he fell under the manipulative thumbs of the Maharishi Yogi, who bled him of every penny he had and left him just a totally ruined man.
Wow.
So I drew that into the novel. Yeah, that probably, I think, I don't know if that book even sold a single copy, but I'm proud of it.
Yeah, it's a great book, and it's very, very interesting. Yeah, so people listeners should go out and get that book right now.
Good, yeah. Vanishing Magic of Snow. It is. Now that's part of, we have the, in terms of the offerings for readers, we have the, okay, so the Boss McTavish Mysteries, there were four. There are about to be four entries for Seattle Bob Mysteries, going on a fifth book, The Wrath of Bob, which will come out next year, concluding the series. But then we have the Vanishing Magic of Snow, Nobility, and a couple of others, Caesar's Ghost, come under a series that, wonders. They're independent reads. The Fast and the Furies is the name of the series. People on the run from their karma.
Hmm. When you wrote the Boss series, right, you were in, is it North Carolina?
I began, okay, no, oh, I was in Charlotte. Yep, Charlotte. Mm-hmm.
And then you went to Seattle. And
first,
you're working toward another move. Are you going to create fiction for that new area?
Yes, I'm going to. I haven't come up with a name for the Tucson something. I can't repeat the Bop. That Seattle Bop is going to stay. That's its own series. But they've kind of evolved in an interesting way. It's like the Boss McTavish series just kind of gave me that feeling. Hey, it's time. This guy has gone through total hell. I mean, he almost died. In the course of one of his books, his fiance is murdered. He loses friends. But at the end, he has fallen in love and is going to get married. So we make the segue then into Seattle Bop with Dirty Boy, who is now Chief Armstrong. And I found myself at this point, he also has gone through his own personal journey, and he's getting to the point where he's getting closer to getting married. So, gosh, does this mean that I have something against marriage? I don't know. It was definitely time after all these years that I've spent with him. Hey, give the guy a break. Let him have his life. We're going to take two people. I have a character that I love, this Russian character who has joined them. I'm going to have him give him a star, at least a co-starring role in the new series.
Oh, I see. So it's going to be another spinoff.
It is. Yep. And I couldn't. It was a question of logistics. I definitely have to move. I mean, it's time to move on. Tucson is calling to me because It would be very hypocritical of me to continue writing about Seattle. I've grown really disenchanted with this town, and I can't. The impetus to set further books in the city isn't there. Hmm. And the fifth book, the one I mentioned, the last book in the series, they set off on a vacation, and they're going to end up in Arizona, a couple of towns I've invented, and from there to Tombstone. So we've already set the stage for Arizona. We're just going to move it over to Tucson.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you.
Other genres, are you going to stay in mystery, or are you planning on experimenting with anything else?
I'm going to stay with mystery for at least for the time being, but I want to keep my mind open. I'll do one or two of the books set in Tucson. Then it may be time, if it's time to take a break. As you know, I took a break. I spent a large part of the past year working on a tiny, tiny, tiny book of translations of one Latin poet who's pretty difficult. And I ended up with a 55-page book that I love. I'm as proud of that as of anything I've written.
Yes, Sex Pro.
Yeah, a jukebox celebration of Sextus Propertius.
That's right. Well, who is he?
He was a Roman poet, would have been at the, oh gosh, he was writing at the same time as Augustus Caesar.
Okay.
So.
And you've written about Caesar before.
I wrote of Julius Caesar coming back.
Oh, Augustus Caesar, yes, correct.
So his nephew. But Julius Caesar, I wrote about his spirit coming back. And
that's right.
Determined to find Cleopatra and to find his place in the White House. That takes place in Caesar's ghost. He gets reincarnated. Every time he gets close, he gets killed again. So it's kind of dead again with a Caesarian twist. But there. So, yeah, I felt just the call to do that. So when the call comes, I mean, if in one case, to write a book about Julius Caesar, his ghost, or to write a book of seven translations of short poems by this poet, I just follow wherever the voice leads me.
Well, with the book on Latin, what drew you to that?
Well, I've loved Latin poetry since I worked in Oxford Bookstore. It started as a mystery. I just couldn't understand. I mean, I would be looking at the classic shelf, and these were, to me, those that are published by the Loeb Classics are like literal translations, word-for-word translations, basically. They're almost unreadable to somebody who isn't using them as like a prop to or a trot rather to understand the Latin. Or the Penguin translations are usually okay with prose, but for poetry they're pretty boring too. Mm. And I kept wondering why, you know, this language must have been alive. There must have been something there for readers 2,000 years ago. They didn't have jukeboxes, of course, but maybe the feeling was there. It was that kind of a rocking sensation. It's like, hey, this is better than what my mom and dad are reading. I mean, this is wild. This is alive. So I wondered for the Latin book. Propertius has been very difficult because his thing, he was a divided soul. He wrote passionate love poetry, but then he would take in the course of a passionate love poem, he would intersperse like the names of two or three dozen gods that we would need a classical dictionary to figure out who the devil they are these days. Mm. And I said, wow, okay, that worked maybe 2,000 years ago, but What if we were to take the gods out, just remove the names of the gods and everything, and treat these as passionate love, rocking love poems? I wondered if I could bring them to life in a fun way that even students who think Latin poetry or Latin literature is boring, could I show them that it's not? That was the challenge.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. Do you think you're going to find some of that seeping into your fiction?
That's hard to say. It could, I mean, yeah, I'm open. I might eventually do another, if this takes, and I've already had one very positive reaction, an email I got yesterday from a highly placed academic who wants to refer this book to her students and to her colleagues. So if word spreads and it's there, I could pursue something else, another jukebox celebration, maybe even of a different writer. As to whether it could work into my fiction, I don't know. If there's some mystery, almost anything can be the subject for a mystery. Even Josephine Tay's Daughter of Time, you've got a hero who's bedridden for the whole bloody novel, solving a mystery. So possibly I could have an academic translator who discovers the buried within a poem the instructions to find a buried treasure, maybe. I don't know. That sounds like I'm, who knows?
Well, you could have a new, whole new academic career.
Hey, that'd be fun. I'll be in the right town for it.
I know, Tucson. Right?
I'm going to be a half-mile walk from the University of Arizona, so I'm going to keep my options open.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned some of your influences. Do you have any influences that might surprise your fans?
I do.
Something, whether it's, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a writer. It could be movies, TV, people walking down the street.
Well, I think, let me see. Yes, I'm going to give you a mixture. Thanks for allowing me to do a blend here. One of the biggest influences for me was Ira Levin. Not Rosemary's Baby. I'm thinking of The Boys from Brazil and a mystery he wrote. It was just incredible. I mean, his plotting is so tense. It's no wonder that Stephen King calls him the greatest Swiss watchmaker of, you know, suspense writers. He was a big influence. I read a couple of his books. I reread 40, 50 times until I had underlined every single line in the book, and they were just falling apart from my studies. Lawrence Sanders, I mentioned, because I think he's hard-boiled, but he's tough, but he's also extremely elegant. And every now and then, he'll come across on a page or every other page just a sentence that drops your jaw, and you say, wow, that is beautiful. One of the actors who has influenced me the most, I mean, he's appeared in one form or another in several books, is Lee Marvin. I'm just amazed by an amazing actor. He just had this presence about him. He doesn't make a big deal of it. In fact, he would have been, I guess, if he were younger today, and I guess he'd have to put on 40, 50 pounds of muscle, but he would have been ideal for Jack Reacher.
Definitely.
He just had that Marine. He was a Marine, and it shows in the way he moves, the way he acts, the way he talks.
Yeah, a lot of actors from that time, they were in the military, so it kind of transferred or translated.
That's really about it. I'm a huge fan of, I just like tightly plotted. I like films and TV that combine, humor and action. I'm a huge fan of the Mission Impossible series here with Tom Cruise. The sting operations that appear in several of the Bob books have been inspired by the Mission Impossible movies. That's
Those
all I can think of right now.
Well, I'm wondering, at the end of the day, when you've finished, you finished a chapter, or maybe when you finished a book, do you do anything to relax and recharge and rejuvenate for the next work?
I do. Between books, I just keep on going. I'll jump from one book into the outline for another. I enjoy that period. That's relaxing for me. I'm going to be spending 3 months at least asking questions and filling my Moleskine notebooks. So, I mean, I've got that's a good way for me to recharge. But also I have I've had to pull back a little bit because of a strained back and the knee operation. But I have my kettlebells for keeping in shape and studying Latin. I mean, that is the big reboot for me. I love it. I spend at least an hour, sometimes two a day, just working on learning the language. What else can I do? And I don't drink or smoke or do drugs.
That's right. What do you do, right? As the old song says.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, do you have a website? How do people get in touch with you? You have social media?
I have a page on Facebook. I think my email address is listed there. I just, within the past 4 or 5 months, I did set up a website because I originally was just planning to set up a blog for reviews, but I learned that, you know, for a little investment, I could also have a website to go with it. The website I'm still working on, but it comes under, they can look under Reb McGrath's Rogue Reviews.
Well, we're going to we'll put all that stuff up on the website so listeners can find it with one click.
Right, and they can easily visit my Amazon author page just to see the books listed in order with little descriptions of them and everything. But yeah, do check out their website, Reb McGrath's Rogue Reviews.
What do you think of the new way of, I mean, I know it kind of brought you back in through ebooks and stuff, but anybody and their brother can write a review of your books and stuff. How do you feel about that? Do you usually read your reviews, or do you stay away from them?
I've looked at them. So far, I've been, I guess so far I've been blessed in not having that many. For one of the Seattle Bop books, I got close to 50 reviews, and they were all 4 and 5 stars. But I know that the risk is involved there. One thing I don't do is free giveaways. Free giveaways, even lowering the price to 99 cents is inviting disaster, because you're getting people that probably aren't going to read the book, and they're probably not going to like anything you write.
Yes.
I mean, that can kill a career. So I'm careful with that. I watch reviews. I'll keep an eye on it. But I guess Hemingway said, if you're going to read and like your good reviews, you've got to at least consider the bad ones. And I try to keep an open mind if somebody comes out and trashes the little book of poetry. But then again, the price is important. I deliberately did not print the Latin book as a Kindle book, because I would have sold it then for 99 cents or $1.99. That would have invited disaster. Even though I make it clear that these are not literal translations of the original poem, they're performances, they're renditions. So you got to be prepared. It's a mixed bag, Dave.
It seems like price does matter today. In how they view the story or the book or whatever you're putting out there.
Well, price does matter. The other thing too is to keep in mind, I don't remember her name, but the huge self-publishing sensation. She went from just a total Kindle author to the point where her sales were so enormous that she landed a huge publishing deal with a major publishing house. But that's less likely to happen if you don't have, I think, those numbers. I think publishers would be put off. I mean, in my case, I don't see it being a huge problem. The fact that they've appeared on Kindle to start with, because my sales are not enormous. I mean, I'm doing the best work I'm capable of doing, and I'm not pandering to an audience. I'm not writing down so that I can jack up my sales, and I'm not pricing so that I can get better numbers. I don't think in terms of units. I think in terms of quality and the books. So one day, an agent out there or a publisher, I really believe this, is going to come around and say, hey, it doesn't matter if these books have sold. These books are terrific. So what if they sold a couple hundred copies or even a couple thousand? That's not a deal breaker. It shouldn't be.
No, it shouldn't be. And I'm sure it feels better, doing stuff that you want to do, that you love, and not writing to the market.
I believe that. And I think most of us can tell if somebody's just, grinding them out at the speed of light. There's a huge difference between, I think readers are, most readers out there, I think, are sensitive. Even if they don't know the technical terms for a technique that a writer is using, I think they could tell the difference between a book that's been carefully thought out, carefully polished, carefully prepared, and all of these things, as opposed to something that was just turned out. Okay, 3 months have passed. I got to get on the next book. At least that's what keeps me going. I like to think that that's true.
Yes, it absolutely is. And it looks like we are about out of time. We have been here today with the author, Reb McGrath. He has written a book called The Rock. Well, he's written a whole bunch of books, but the book we've been talking about today is The Rock of Bop, a Seattle Bop Mystery Book 3. You have to go out there and get that book now. And thanks for being here, Reb.
Dave and Al, thanks very much for having me on the show. I've had a good time.
Thank you.
Waking me up again.
Okay. The next time I'm on the show, then we can get into my second marriage.
There we go.
Okay, guys. Thank you.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.